Hi, this is Robert Shearer with another edition of Shearer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, in this case, Farlaine Roussel, a sociology professor at the University of Paris, who is a leading expert on the American entertainment industry and its impact, for better or worse, on the world's culture. Welcome. Let me take advantage of your knowledge. I'm talking to one of the great professors of sociology and expert on popular culture. It's Violaine Roussel, right?
Violaine Roussel.
So much for my 5 years of French or whatever it was. But let's focus on this, the Americanization of the world. It's sort of a horrifying prospect when you extend it to cultural life. It's one thing when we used to make very good cars and maybe people wanted them. That's no longer the case. The irony here is our exports are primarily intellectual and cultural. Let me take up that point, because we have resistance against what's called cultural imperialism. And I know, for example, the Chinese market looms very large in the mind of Hollywood. Increasingly, movies have to succeed in China, and they get tailored a bit. And then, we're starting to see some movies made in China come out. India, of course, has a vibrant film market. So could you give me kind of a summary view at this point in history? Is the American cultural experience, whatever that means, extended through television and film, more powerful than ever in the world? Are there challenges to it?
There are challenges to it. It's definitely, at this point, a dominant industry, very influential. I think China is sort of a promised land for Hollywood, but Hollywood sometimes doesn't yet know quite how to conquer it. It's in the process of happening, but it hasn't happened fully yet. And as far as Europe is concerned, there is a dominant position of Hollywood. I wouldn't go as far as to say that there is cultural hegemony of Hollywood, in that sense that locally there are local pockets of resistance with industries that still flourish and exist and have an audience. France is an example of it. There are other European examples. There are rules and regulations and limitations that are created both by certain countries in Europe and also at the EU level to try to limit the impact of this cultural dominance of Hollywood. And it works to an extent, but it does not... It's not enough to really stop it.
Is the export of Hollywood culture, Hollywood defined as made in America, both television and movies, is it 50% of the world's culture, 70%?
It's really hard to give just a single number like that, because countries like China are able to limit that with their own rules.
Well, let's take the EU then.
In France, at least, it depends what kind of, what categories of movie you're looking at. If you're looking at blockbuster movies, the big franchise movies are really huge in France. And you have, I don't have like a very precise number, but you have maybe 80% of what's in the theater.
Okay.
But you also have a lot of small, but that's, I really want to make the point that it's not the only thing that you find, that you still have this industry and the small movies, and people go to the theater, which is also something that's at stake. Why in France, a service like Netflix has had so much trouble, so much that they had to move to a different country in the EU, because there is a real desire, I think, both from the government and the people, and also the professionals of the industry, to preserve this active practice of people that they go in the theater and to see the small movies.
It was the conceit that you somehow would develop your own vibrant retain your own vibrant culture. And it extended to every aspect of life, the food, the way you consume food, the music, the way you relate, the conversation, so forth. And when we talk about blockbuster movies and so forth, you're talking about capturing the imagination of the youth. You're talking about defining a culture. And so the reason I'm trying to put this in some percentage terms, after all of this time, and now we're talking, you know, a century, starting to get on a century of influence, taking that 80%, and I realize this is a crude statistic, these are the blockbuster movies are also the ones that use the highest level of technology, the best special effects, and so forth. So you're really determining, it's like the old thing about the cuisine being challenged by fast food, you know, McDonald's or what have you, you're actually determining the culture of people in Italy and Germany and France who were very prideful concerning the preservation of their culture. And you're basically suggesting that war has been lost.
I don't want to be I don't want to go too far by saying that it's already lost, but it's definitely, there is definitely dominance there. And not just by America, by Hollywood. And, you know, because there are also, I also don't want to give the impression that in France or in Europe, it's all indie movies. And in here, in Hollywood, it's only blockbuster movies, because it's not the case. There is also a culture for indie films here. By the way, one of the good effects of France still subsidizing film and cinema and offering stable conditions for partnerships, unlike China, for instance, where, you know, maybe it's a promised land, but tomorrow we don't know what's going to happen. It's pretty unstable. Is that there are a lot of co-productions, even if there is not like a co-production agreement signed between the US and France, practically, there are a lot of joint productions between European countries and producers and artists and creators from the U.S. in
We live
world.
In a multinational world economy, and there's a lot of transference. But I, you know, I'm old enough to remember, as I used the word, the conceit of, I knew some of these French filmmakers, René and Godard in particular. The fact is they thought they were in a war against Hollywood commercialism and so forth. And again, it seems to me that war has been lost. Now, you have been to the belly of the beast. And in fact, interestingly enough, you took the sort of hustler aspect of the business, the agent, right? And you decided to become an expert on Hollywood agents. I find that fascinating. And I also find it interesting they let you in. I'm going to hold that thought and take a break, but I'm going to ask you, as having spent so much time and written a really important, the most important book on Hollywood agents, really, who are they? How much power do they have? And is this an exaggeration to say that they control the action? They certainly make a lot of money. And we'll take a break now and be back in a little while, a minute or two, we're back. Okay, we're back with Brulane Rousseau. We're talking about her book about Hollywood agents. So let me rephrase that question. How important are these Hollywood agencies? Do they dumb down the agents? Do they dumb down the product? Do they package it? Tell us about your experience. You went in the door. And why did they let you in the door?
Oh, that's a very good question that I asked myself. So when I decided, that was almost 10 years ago, that I started doing the investigation for this book that came out in 2017, Representing Talent is the title of the book. And my project initially was to study the agents and the agencies, Hollywood agents, mostly because it had never been done before, at least not from a social science, sociological perspective. And I was really curious, really, you know, not having a lot of preconceived ideas, because I'm really literally coming from a different world. Especially then, I was just arriving in California from Paris, and I didn't know a lot of people in Hollywood at all. And I was really curious about their role and their power, given that the biggest agencies, CAA, WME now, UTA, ICM, what they sometimes call the big four agencies, they are huge organizations. They have thousands of employees sometimes. And so all of this activity and the power of the very famous figures of agents was very puzzling to me. So I decided to study what they do, what is their impact, what's their role, and how do they really affect and maybe contribute to shape the art.
So what's the quick and dirty answer? Are they a sleazy bunch who just want to make every buck they can, and or as they often pride themselves, they elevate the product, put together a magical director with the actor, wonderful things happen, and they are basically the master chef who produces the wonderful cake?
I think they're both. So on one hand, of course, that there is business in show business. And they are the guardians of that sort of dirty secret of Hollywood, that there is business in show business. And it's, in a way, you know, it's easy to blame the agent for worrying about the money, but the clients, the artists, also want to get paid and make money and make good money if possible. So even though they are, for the most part, really dedicated to making good art. So what I was looking at and what I was able to see when I was, you know, at the beginning, it wasn't that easy to get into the agencies and being able to interview. I interviewed 122 agents and their counterparts, other Hollywood professionals that they're working with.
Did any of them offer you jobs?
I almost got offered a job at an agency, but I also made it clear that I couldn't be affiliated with any agency in particular because you're very quickly placed in the game, and I couldn't be associated with one agency and then do
my
observation.
The reason I make that point is my experience with these folks. The money, you mentioned the money, yes, they want to make good money. The money is incredible. People don't talk about it. They talk about the art. They talk about everything else. But when you're there and when you're in on it, you know, my goodness, people are cognizant of the money. It's a drug. It's everything. And these people, if they make this decision and they put you with that one and you get green light, then suddenly we're talking about megabucks, right?
There is big money, especially towards the top of the game, meaning what I called big Hollywood. Because there are, you know, when I started this study of agencies, I also realized that there are really two Hollywood, two film and TV world, two entertainment industries in one, in a way. One is this world of the very small, sometimes just one person, or small agencies that have clients that are either developmental, you know, people who are not yet very well known, who are just starting, or people who have fallen out of favor, and they work with casting directors, and for the most part, the clients find, you know, a role in a job in a TV show or something like that. And then you have the big Hollywood with the big agencies, what I called before the big four agencies, and this is really where the power play is happening, with the big studios being the counterparts and the stars being the clients. So, of course, this is where there is big money. This is also where people want to, or everybody wants to make a lot of money, not just the agents. So, and that's interesting. You know, right now there is this big controversy between the Writers Guild and the Association of Talent Agents regarding what they call packaging, and for the most part, packaging for television. So putting together the key elements in a show and selling it as a package to a buyer, the network, the studio. And the agency is making money from that, is fee, from a packaging fee, from packaging for television shows. And there is this controversy with where is the money coming from? Who is benefiting the most? Is it the client? Is it the agency? Is it both? Because normally and legally, the client and the agent have exactly the same interest. The agent is making 10, or not the agent, but the agency is making 10% of what the client is making. So it's in the agent's best interest that the client is making more money and vice versa. So there is also this very close tie between who is on the side of the, on the business side of show business, everybody, and who has an interest in having some quality work attached to their name as an agency. It's also everybody.
I understand that. But the, again, the scam here, and it comes out in the Academy Awards more than any other place, but the other awards as well, is that there is somehow important art, content, controversy associated with these things. And of course, there is to some degree. But Hollywood is one of the most amazing industries in being able to hold both an enormous sense of market corruption and advancement and greed in your head with a notion of idealism and art and saving humanity. It's stupefying to experience, both from the outside watching some of this. And yes, there are great movies, there is great art and so forth. A lot of it is crap. A lot of it is exploitive and so forth. And it's an odd industry in that respect. And one thing that I've noticed happened actually belonged to the Actors Guild and the Writers Guild only because I was required working on different things. But I've noticed when I go to these guild things, screening of movies and so forth, 95% of the people haven't worked regularly in their life. You know, they had one thing popped up. Most of the time they're sitting at Starbucks working on some project that hopefully will get to turn around but never be turned around, and so forth. Now, I understand that, but you have a weird industry where you have a medieval notion of the guilds, the unions, and there's a pretense that there's some order to it, moving up the levels and so forth, you know, the Directors Guild and all that. And on the other hand, you have these cartels owned by, you know, very powerful, you know, foreign companies often, or big companies, and who are squeezing every dollar and maximizing every bit of sales. And don't you find it kind of one of the oddest, most hypocritical, confused centers of life?
What I would say is that the way that the industry is currently transforming is making it much less about art and much more about turning a buck. And the whole media conglomerates, global growth, concentration that we are now observing as an effect that, you know, you could think is a terrible effect, because what's happening in the movie industry itself doesn't matter that much anymore for these very big conglomerates. And for...
Name some of those conglomerates as an example.
Well, the big studios are now owned by Comcast, Viacom, AT&T. So
where they're getting most of their money from other things.
Exactly. And it doesn't move the needle if a movie makes it or doesn't, is good or is bad, and even makes a lot of money or doesn't, because this is not that much money for those big media conglomerates. And that, to me, presents a risk.
Hollywood's now the tail of the dog, right?
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, because most people thinking about it, when they watch, you know, stars and when they watch the Academy, oh, these people are setting the whole culture. No, they're responding to commercial market people who see them as just sort of one of their smaller
and
lines
power,
of activity.
For better or worse, is not what it used to be. Yeah. Partly because of that, and also in relationship to that, to some extent, the studios are now, as you have all noticed, I'm sure, making a lot of these franchise movies, reboots and sequels, and not as much original one-off movies that could be more creative, more...
Right,
know,
and one of the things that's confusing, particularly you find it with documentaries, where there are a lot of very good documentaries made that no one ever sees, or very few people do. There are a lot of small movies made that we like, we recommend it to our friends, and then you ask other people, they never heard about it. And then the big blockbusters are the ones that get the attention. I want to, again, to get back to our original point, whoever owns it, the American entertainment industry, broadly speaking, sets the example, the culture, is the main educator. I don't want to go too far, but it's kind of the ball game of in defining who we're going to be as people, no matter where we live. What we think about love, what we think about integrity, what we think about race, what we think about gender. Pretty much, sometimes it's good. I think you could argue on the question of gay rights, Hollywood broke, made a revolution almost overnight, and that was, you know, very significant. You could argue in a number of other areas, some not so good when it comes to exposing corporate corruption or so forth. But okay, the reason we need to know about this, it sets the world's culture. It's not isolated. It's America's main, most significant export. Okay. Now I want to get to what people see as this great crack in the system, this great where the light gets through, to quote Leonard Cohen, you know, and that is the new technology, the new streaming, the new distribution. And I know you've done a lot of work on it. We don't have time to do it justice, but give us the picture now. Is the industry changing in a fundamental way?
It is,
and is
huge,
this good or bad?
And I'm still studying it. It's my next book. The streaming platform, the streaming services, and now the new giants that are Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, and also the newcomers, Apple TV Plus just, you know, launched its program, Facebook and YouTube are creating original content. These are very, very important new players in this game that you just described that's very influential for global culture. And it's very interesting. There are many, many dimensions. It is changing what we consume, the way we consume it, the tool with which, on which we consume it. Now we can watch movies on our phone, anywhere, cut it in small pieces. These are also entities, companies that have a lot of money or put a lot of money out there. And sometimes directors, creators like it because they're offered the opportunity to do some of the projects that they couldn't do before in the old system. And it's also, in this way, it's a great opportunity. It also creates very complex situation in the new ways in which they are paid. They don't get the same type of royalties that they used to get with television, for instance, where there was syndication. This is gone practically. So it's a revolution. And yes, it is changing what we get as viewers, as users of these platforms, what is the type of culture that we get and how we get to...
Well, but that's what I want to, and I know we don't have time to do this in a complex scholarly way, but I want to know, you know, is this good or bad?
I think it's potentially good, but it could turn out to be bad if we're not paying attention. It's really, as with technology to me is not good and bad per se. So I'm not going to say it's necessarily bad because it's more technical or clinical or anything like that. Even if in Hollywood, sometimes I hear people lament about the lost art of their old professional practice that was much more intuitive. You can use technology and make it wonderful, but it's only if, I guess, we as citizens are careful about the way in which it may just become the only thing that we are offered. You know, it's really hard to sum it up in 10 seconds.
Yeah, but let me challenge you right there. We were discussing oxymorons before. The idea of a careful consumer is an oxymoron. The whole idea of sales, marketing, advertising is to get people not to be careful. It's to get them to lust for, I mean, I want to oversimplify the whole history of marketing, but to define it as an answerable question, will there be a greater diversity? will there be greater choice in the product? Does this liberate more people to make things that might find an audience?
They want you to believe that it's greater choice. It's all that Netflix tells you, that now they offer greater choice and that they have a different model that allows them to create things for different kind of niche audiences that didn't get their specific type of product before. On the other hand, they are using data, the data that they have, that we give them. This is where the citizen can be careful and be have their eyes open and not be too naive in terms of what is the data that we willingly give to all of these big players. You know, Google and Amazon, they do a lot of other things. They, you know, other than just making content.
I know. I recently wrote a book called They Know Everything About You and explored
exactly.
this. But when you
I think there is something for the citizen to do.
When you say there's something for the citizen to do, this is, I think, the illusion, if I can challenge this. Because I sign on to Netflix and let's say I want to watch a movie like 50 Shades of Grey. Okay, does this mean I'm a sadomasochist? Does this reflect? No, it's something that's discussed. I want to watch it. In fact, I found it very boring. I only watch it for 5 minutes. That data is in their system. Now, that then defines me as a customer. Now, I really didn't have much choice because if you really want, you know, to sign on, can we use your data? Can we use your location? All of this data is what makes the whole experience accessible. And if you rebel, you might as well go live in a shack somewhere and cut off the grid, because the fact is it's not designed to empower us.
Absolutely.
That's an illusion.
It's built in. You're right. It's not designed to empower us. But that doesn't mean that we cannot empower ourselves by, for instance, using other platforms, other tools, or even building them. Right now, there are also other options. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to use Netflix, but I can try. And there are users that are trying to trick the system by using the sort of subgenres that Netflix is creating and typing them in the, you know, the sort of subject line. And you can, in this way, get another list of shows offered to you as your personalized, you know, screen that you wouldn't with their algorithm.
Okay, I understand that. And if I'm being abrupt, it's just because we're going to run out of time. But I want to push this a little bit further. And this is where government can come in, or other watchdogs, consumer and so forth. So we've had some pushback on the privacy issues, data mining and everything from the European Union. They have actually challenged Google and Facebook, which make most of the money now, and they get it off invading your privacy and getting this data, and there's been pushback. We don't get much pushback in America from and protection of consumer rights. So let me ask you, as somebody who crosses the Atlantic frequently and so forth, will there be counterpowers in the world to this internet commerce and commercialization of everything? Is the pushback, say, from the European Union, is that significant?
It is something that is happening right now before our eyes. It's difficult to know if it's going to be successful and to what extent. For instance, the government is also very worried about getting money from those big companies that have sort of an extraterritorial status in terms of where they pay taxes or where they don't pay taxes. Like, for instance, in the EU, one of the reasons why the EU wants to mobilize and create new regulations to control those Netflix and Amazon and Google and the likes is not, I mean, I don't want to say that they don't care about protecting the citizens, but it's also primarily because they want those taxes not to just disappear, but they want for the state to be able to restore some control about that. So maybe as a side effect of that, we will also have some
form
of control.
So we're screwed. You're basically saying we're screwed.
I think that collectively, if we organize, but not necessarily by expecting the state to solve it for us.
How do we collectively organize against Amazon? Let's take Amazon as an example. They now are in everything. You want to buy organic food, they own Whole Foods. You want to buy this, you know, they will present you with the choices. You want those earphones? Here are the other five you might consider. And they have all your data. They can target you. And if you cannot think that through the democratic process, through government, that you can control this, it's obviously hopeless.
It's complicated because right now governments are also challenged for not necessarily offering those democratic avenues that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And to compare with something that we are, as you know, French people, we are living on a day-to-day basis right now, this big social movement of the Yellow Jackets. These are people who have first organized through the internet. It's a really bottom-up movement. And whether you like them or not, because there is a lot of controversy around them and their mode of action, they are an organized group using the internet at the start, at least, and even now, to tell the government, we want more social justice and we want more democracy in a more participatory way. I don't want to say that the individual is the solution, but I do believe, maybe it's naive of me, but I really do believe that collectively there are possibilities, and I'm not saying that it's easy at all, but there are possibilities to organize. And of course, yes, use the governmental resources when we can, but also when the government doesn't provide those responses to go and get them.
I do want to summarize, I think, and ask you as a takeaway from this. Basically, what you're saying is the old engines of that were driving world culture are not what they used to be. Studios really don't matter. The big filmmakers don't matter. The big directors don't matter in the old way. That they have now been overwhelmed by these huge conglomerates. And these huge conglomerates can now, and this is the example of Amazon or Netflix or whatever, they can also develop alternative ways of shaping our mind, our culture, our aspiration. And from my point of view, which is more pessimistic than yours, this is a prescription for the end of freedom. However, the Yellow Jackets, other movements, people used to hold out the Arab Spring and what happened in Egypt with Google. But then, of course, the military took over. They now can use the internet to more effectively control the population. And the Arab Spring seems to have been snuffed out. Maybe by the time this is even heard on the radio, the Yellow Jackets will have been snuffed out in France. So, yes, it's the best and worst of worlds. But you can't take anything for granted. And you can't even take the mythology of Hollywood of a strong, independent director saying to the studios, I'm going to make this movie, and managing to get the movie. And I, for instance, just last night here at USC in class, I had one of America's truly great directors, Oliver Stone, who dared use movies to challenge the dominant narrative, to raise questions. And that really is not possible anymore in this configuration.
Yes. I have to agree with Oliver Stone that Hollywood has changed, and that the power of the director or the star, the power of the star, is not what it used to be. So it's another reason why we should try to find collectively any way we can to use the new tools to sort of reactivate or rejuvenate that power of the artist. And I even think, maybe that's a little bit of a provocation, but that some of the agents that I interviewed in my book who were really nostalgic from that time where they were taking pride in representing great artists would join us.
And I think your insight is really important. What you've brought in your writing and your scholarship really is the excellence of academic life. and yet you applied it to the nitty-gritty of this real world. I want to thank you, Brulane Rousseau. Thank you for your work. I want to thank you for sharing it with us. That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Our producer is Joshua Sheer. Our engineers at KCRW are Mario Diaz and Kat Ure. And here at USC at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, Sebastian Grubar has once again delivered excellent engineering. Thank you. Sacamos.